Hello and welcome to the Nourish Balance Thrive podcast. My name is Christopher Kelly. Today I'm delighted to present to you once again Dr. Mike T. Nelson, PhD. Mike has spent the last 18 years learning how the human body works, specifically focusing on properly conditioning it to burn fat and to become stronger, more flexible and healthier. He's been called to share his techniques with top government agencies, universities and colleges, fitness organizations and fanatics. The techniques he's developed and the result Mike gets for his clients have been featured in international magazines, scientific publications and websites across the globe. On the podcast today, Mike talks about his Flex Diet Certification Program, a course for trainers, coaches and fitness enthusiasts on metabolic flexibility, working with clients on nutrition and achieving fitness goals. We also talk about a little bit of everything else. His recent talk at the ISSN conference, measuring and improving your VO2 max, creating training plans and the best ways to assess for fitness and health span. Mike's Flex Diet Certification Program takes students 1 to 2 times a year and is open today through the 22nd of January 2024. So if you're listening to this before the 22nd of January 2024, head over to flexdiet.com where you can sign up for Mike's program. Just before we get into this podcast, I'd like to ask for your help. Our dear friend, colleague and mentor, Dr. Simon Marshall, has been diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. While Simon is fortunate to have excellent health insurance, the standard care options available for pancreatic cancer can somewhat limit their effectiveness. In their quest for the best possible outcome, Simon and his wife Les are exploring new and emerging treatments, therapies and modalities. These groundbreaking approaches offer hope, but they come at a significant cost. To meet these costs, Les has set up a GoFundMe campaign linked in the show notes for this episode. Your contribution, whether big or small, will significantly impact Simon's fight against pancreatic cancer. Thanks for your support. Now over to this week's interview with Mike T. Nelson. Well, Mike, thank you so much for joining me this morning. What a privilege to have you again for the fourth time on the Nourish Balance Thrive.
Oh, it's the fourth time already. That's crazy.
Fourth time already, yeah. I'm so grateful for experts like you that come onto my show and you basically give me all of your knowledge for free. And to the listener, that's such an incredible gift. So thank you.
Yeah, no problem. Thank you for having me.
Tell us about the Flex Diet podcast. I've been listening to that a lot recently. And I really like the style. It feels like Mike went to a conference and he got talking to another one of the speakers and in the back of a taxi, or maybe that he would sit beside them in a lecture hall somewhere. And this is just like we're kind of somehow managing to overhear your chat that you had with this other PhD expert person. And I really like that style. It feels like it's more geared towards coaches. Would you say that's true?
Yeah, it's geared more towards coaches. I'd say intermediate to advanced fitness enthusiasts. And yeah, and thank you for the compliment, because I had this idea years ago. Like, I'm sure you had the same idea for your podcast, is that I would go to these conferences or you'd have like a 3-hour dinner with, you know, so-and-so. And I kept thinking for years, I'm like, man, I wish someone could record this, because I don't know if people would want to listen to what I was talking about, but I would want to hear other conversations that are happening like this in other locations with other people. And when I started the podcast on my own, I've been on iHeartRadio for many years, and I just started my own. It was probably 2 years ago now. And initially it was very formal, I had like my whole list of questions. I remember doing one with Don D'Agostino, who I've known for years, and I did all my preparation. I had all my questions. I went back, reviewed all of his studies and everything. And he comes on there and he's like, yeah, I just did a 72-hour fast. I'm going to go deadlift after this. I was like, what? What are you? And I realized at that point that I just threw out like all the questions I had, because that was way more interesting. You had all these red lights in the back. Yeah. And it was kind of after that I realized, I'm like, oh, if I'm bored doing the podcast, like, why am I doing it? Part of it is just my own self-interest. Selfish. I pay for it. Like, it costs me money. But then to have other people listen in on those conversations. And yeah, to me, that's just a lot more fun. I think you get more interesting things from other people that way, as opposed to being formulaic. And if I hear one more freaking podcast that starts out with, oh, and tell me what it is you do now again, and they seem all very formulaic, it's the same thing all the time.
Scripted.
It just bores me to tears.
That's funny you should say that, because I remember in 2014 approaching Dominic D'Agostino at the Ancestral Health Symposium in Berkeley and being all kind of coy and shy and like, I'd only had a couple of podcast interviews to my name at that time and asking him if he would be on my podcast. And he just said, sure, when you want to do it. I'm like, oh my God, this is amazing. Yeah. Of course, and the symposium was just like such a great source of content for the podcast. So yeah, I owe a lot to those conferences for sure.
Yeah, they're fun. And Dom's just great. Like he's super nice, down-to-earth guy, especially for all the stuff that he's done.
Yeah. And where can people find, you know, I always wonder, I hear you hear talk about these talks that you've given at the conferences. Are they ever recorded and are they available online? Like I know recently you talked about psychedelics and I'm like, oh, I want to watch that talk. How do I see that?
What I might do, if people want to email me, if they want to see the psychedelic talk, let me know. Unfortunately, a lot of them aren't filmed, which kind of annoys me, but I get it. If you're an organization, it's more money, it's more cost and all that kind of stuff. But after it's been, I don't know what the time lapse is on it, but probably I could probably redo that talk as a screencast if people are interested. So some of them I might start doing those because, as you know, to like to prepare an actual, especially more the formal-ish academic talks, it's a pain in the ass to do that. Like the amount of research and time it takes to do all that is a lot of effort. And it, I love doing it. It was great. It was, you know, very well received, but it also just seems weird that it's a small audience of only 200-300 people that get to ever see it.
Yeah. Well, that's amazing. I'll tell you a funny story about psychedelics. We've been hosting our house on Airbnb this year in Santa Cruz. And one time, somebody left some mushrooms in our oven, would you believe? The cleaner found them. Said, hey, what are these? And I look at them and I'm like, pretty sure I recognize that blue color, you know?
Yeah.
So they sat in my drawer for a long time and then they came out on New Year's Day, just 12 days ago as a recording. We had some friends over and a couple of us did these mushrooms. We did 3 grams of these dried mushrooms.
Ooh,
and we went for a walk in the Redwoods here.
How'd
that go? And it was the, man, one of the things, I just can't believe I waited this long to try psilocybin, right? It's just absolutely incredible. And like one of the standout things, I mean, it wasn't particularly inward and introspective because you've got other people there and you're talking and
yeah, and you're outside, was, your eyes are open.
You're on the outside. Yeah, the visuals are so distracting. But one of the things I remember the most, we have a wood stove that's our only source of heat. And it was kind of a cold day. We're inside towards the end and I'm sat there just like staring at the flames in the wood stove and everyone's gone quiet. And I'm looking after, actually another podcast guest, Brianna Stubbs, another ketogenic diet
great.
Expert. Yeah, you know, yeah, we were dog sitting their dog, this beautiful Labrador named Eddie. And it's such an appropriate name. He's like this big cuddly toy. He's only a puppy, but he's still so like, he's really mellow. And just lying there on, we just had a single mattress in our living room, lying on the mattress, like snuggled up to Teddy, looking at the flames is like the most antidepressant, you know, like it's the most amazing healing thing. I can't, but give us the abstract. Can you give us the 30-second summary of your talk on psychedelics?
Sure. Yeah, I did it for the National Society of Sports Nutrition.
And okay.
The main reason I did it is because hopefully later this year, depending on, you know, a lot of places have decriminalized it, but in terms of FDA approval.
Oh, and it is decriminalized in Santa Cruz, by the way. Yeah, like that's maybe
something
to mention.
A lot of places are. Yeah, and hopefully FDA will approve for certain indications, for certain compounds. Who knows what'll be first? But I just felt like, especially going to the ISSN conference, like I always love going to those conferences because you see what is the newest things, like what are the latest and greatest. And I realized a lot of people in that space have the ability to educate other people, you know, they're whether it's academic research or trainers, coaches, and that it was an area that there just isn't a lot of what I feel like good education on based on the research. And so that was kind of the main reason I did it. I did just as a crash course on psychedelics in general. Like, what are the different classifications? What are some of the indications? What are some of the mechanisms of how they might work? What are some of the risks? And, you know, what are some of the rewards? Because I feel like in, at least in the US, we don't have a very good container or very good structure for the use of them outside of a clinical setting. And of course, once they're approved for clinical use, there's obviously places where it's decriminalized. There's going to be use in other areas, which again, I'm not against at all, but it just seems like people are not educated on what are the potential pros and the potential risks. And like every so often I hear people like, oh yeah, we're just gonna go do this ayahuasca ceremony in our apartment this weekend, and I'm like, what are you thinking? Just, I don't know, I just get nervous that a lot of the very good potential and a lot of very good research could potentially be squashed by people doing things that they just had no business doing.
Yeah, I don't think of the mushrooms as like that. I find them very gentle, and I don't think there's any known toxicity. I don't, and there's no puking,
no
or shitting.
No, it's like psilocybin, gentle. there isn't any acute toxicity. You know, the issues you run into with anything that alters your senses, depending upon the dose, depending upon location, set and setting, all that kind of stuff. You could be getting information that's not there that could result in harm. Again, What setting are you in, right? Are you going to, you know, watch the ocean off the side of a cliff and take 4 grams?
Oh.
Probably a very horrible idea, right?
Yeah, I did worry.
In the middle of the woods or somewhere else, someone's watching you.
Yeah, like lighting the stove at one point. I thought, am I lighting a fire inside the stove? Hopefully.
Exactly.
Having a babysitter is not a bad idea.
Oh, very good idea. Yeah, because even just the psychic stress of it, knowing, especially if you don't have any experience with things, to not know what you're going to know. And to me, doing that kind of by yourself, to me, is a very high risk, even of it, the experience itself going a different direction, right? Because your innate stress level, you're worried about what may happen versus being in a very controlled set and setting, people there who have experience, there's people watching you, they've done this before, they know what's going on. To me, that's just a very different potential, both for risk and even outcome. Because how I think about it is that there's no good or bad trips per se, but there's definitely safe and unsafe ones. And so your goal is to just make sure it's a safe experience. What'll happen is what'll happen. But if it's a safe environment and everything is set up that way, you know, at the end of that experience, you'll still be okay.
Talk about the Flex Diet Certification. Who's it for? I wonder whether it's for me. You know, I've been coaching, recording the podcast for 10 years now.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering if someone like me, and we have clients like me, right? Like they have this incredible health transformation and they want to help other people achieve what they've achieved. And I'm wondering whether the Flex Diet Certification would be for them. But what would they be able to do once they have the certificate that they wouldn't have been able to do before?
Yeah, it's basically a certificate for nutrition coaching. We do some recovery. So we do talk a little bit about basic exercise and sleep and some other things. And I initially set it up because, as you know, the world in nutrition is super confusing and everyone has kind of their own opinion.
Other areas aren't. You know, like sleep, I find.
Oh, everything is that way now.
Oh, you think even sleep is like, okay.
Yeah, even sleep is that way. Initially, I set it up as, because I was doing a lot of, you know, training with CrossFit gyms and bigger gyms, and I would go to a gym and I'd be like, hey, what are you doing for programming? And, you know, a lot of better gyms had that all figured out. And I would always ask them, like, hey, what are you guys doing for nutrition? And they're like, well, I don't know, this 30-day challenge and that 30-day challenge. And it just seemed weird that even in that controlled setting, there wasn't anything that was being done. And most of it wasn't scalable and no one really knew where to start. So they would just throw 30-day challenges at them. So I'm like, could I come up with a system where one person in that gym would be in charge of all the nutrition work, but yet it would still be semi-customizable? So it would say start in this direction, but yet per individual, it'd be semi-customizable because everyone's going to be a little bit different. And I set it up with the concepts of metabolic flexibility and flexible dieting. So it is a more flexible approach. And then within that, you learn the big picture, like how those concepts work. And then there's 8 interventions that I had. With each intervention, I limited myself to only 1 hour of technical stuff. So I had 1 hour to tell you technically what you need to know about protein, from leucine, essential amino acids, protein muscle synthesis, blah, blah, blah. But explain it in English so someone could actually understand what was going on. And then there's 5 action items per each area. So within the system, you would learn the overall concept. You would learn enough of the details of what's going on per intervention based on research. But then you would know exactly what to do with the person sitting in front of you. Okay, you're going to work on this action step. You're going to do this for this period of time. Cool. Once we got that, we're going to go on to the next one. So I took the psychology aspects of it and more or less baked that into the system so that they didn't have to get overwhelmed by that at the same time. It's still there. It's still flexible. It's still kind of a client-led approach, but that's all baked into the system because the feedback I got from most trainers, at least people who are communicating with me, was, I just don't know enough about nutrition to do it. And the reality is, they probably do, but they didn't have a system and they didn't have a way of navigating, okay, I start here, I do this and I do that. okay, but why am I doing those things and in what order am I doing it? So, like, for example, a lot of people would start with sleep. They would be like, well, look at all this great research on sleep and clients don't sleep enough, and 100% true, like no argument on that. But as you know, at some point you can only maximize the quality of somebody's sleep so high. If they're sleeping 5 hours a night, they probably need 6 or 7 or 8 hours of sleep. There isn't a real way around it. But at the end of the day, you're like, oh, so that 2 hours I watch Netflix with my spouse at night, you're telling me I should just go to bed. Yeah, you're not going to put your kids up for adoption. You're not going to, you know, not go to your job. You're going to still train. You have all these other things of way your life is set up. And so now I'm telling them to do the one thing that they enjoy, to not do that and to go sleep more. So it's a very, it's an extremely difficult argument. So in terms of the psychological ability of the client to change, the sleep on the 1-to-8 ratio, that was dead last. Yeah, physiologically, lots of good reasons. So, but you contrast that to protein, which is the first intervention, lots of good reasons you should eat more protein, especially for fat loss. You tell someone, hey, I want you to eat more of this specific thing. They're like, well, wait a minute,
you want me
to
eat more of a food?
Like, what's wrong with you? What, you crazy person? But like, well, can you do that? Like, oh yeah, I can do that.
That's great. I love that. And I know the course is, it only opens a couple of times a year, right? And it's about to open soon.
Yeah, it'll be open January 15th through January 22nd, 2024. Okay. Yeah, so it'll be open for a week. Just go to flexdiet.com.
Okay, and I'm going to work super hard to get this podcast out by then, but if by any chance it's a day late, like if it's a day late, well, like people hearing this, can you give them like a code or something, like a magic keyword to say that you heard it here? And
I mean, I normally don't do exceptions outside of a time course, but they can email me and tell me they heard it on this podcast and I'll make an exception for them. So that way only people who listen to this know that.
Okay, excellent. Well, I'd love to talk to you about some of these biometric fancy devices that you've been talking about the podcast recently over spanning several episodes, I'd say. And I'm hoping you're going to be up for talking about that resting metabolic rate and VO2 max and fat burning and HIV. You're up for talking about some of these things?
Yeah, shoot.
Excellent. Well, I guess before like I ask you any questions, I have to sort of state a goal. I feel like that's important always in coaching. Like, what are you trying to achieve? And MPC has always been about performance. That's the, I find the easiest way to like sell someone on any intervention is to an athlete, and it's about performance.
Yes.
But, you know, when you work with people for a while, and I've got to this stage too, you eventually get to this point. In the beginning, like performance is so exciting when you don't know what you're capable of. But once you get to a point, right, you're like, I kind of know what's here, right? Probably more training is not going to do that much, right? Like I found my peak potential. And then people, I think they predictably have this sort of crisis. I had a client say to me once, the juice is not worth the squeeze. And I'm like, that's exactly right, isn't it? The amount of time I put into this, it's just not really worth it to me anymore. And then like the goal shifts, right? More towards health span. How can I've improved a lot over the years. How can I keep this game going for as long as possible? And I guess that's the game of health span. So I think it's like fair for most of the people listening, that would be true, right? Like, and so then I'm interested in, you know, obviously exercise is a part of that. And like, I'm interested in devices that might help me towards that goal of health span. Does that sound like a reasonable goal?
Yeah. I think of it as every physical quality is going to have a certain peak. And depending upon what it is, you have your reward versus your risk of doing that. And then per individual, where do you want to put your time? And at some point, like you said, you are going to hit a peak. And by definition of a peak is there's another downside. So can you not have your downside go off a cliff? And can you kind of make, you might be losing a little bit of ground over time, but you're going to try to minimize that rate of loss. It's the ever-ending fight against entropy.
Business is like that as well. Shit tends to fall apart.
Life is like
and
that.
Your job is to... Okay, so optimizing for health span. Maybe these are bad questions. You can help me on these, right? Right. So I think like, where am I now? And then there's a kind of the corollary to this, which is, am I getting better? I'm interested in any device that can answer those questions. And then there's a sort of the micro level, right? Maybe that's the macro level. The micro level is, what should I do? What workout should I do today? Like, that's a question that I always have. And another one is, am I doing it right? Right. I'm working with Mike. So I know what I'm doing today, But Mike's not here right now, and I don't know if I'm doing it right, you know? Like, so maybe if you agree that those are reasonable questions, then we can talk about some of those devices and how they can help me answer some of those questions. What do you think?
Yeah, I would agree. And I would say the overarching thing is, what do you want to do? So for like with clients, like if they come to me and say, okay, my number one goal is I want to maximize health span as much as possible. And we're just looking at training. Okay, well, what do we know about that? We know that the top three that we have pretty good data are VO2 max, grip strength, lower body muscle mass, and strength, right? Someone else, like for me personally, yeah, I want to do good on those things, but my main goal is more kiteboarding, hit a 30-foot jump. My main performance goals within that are to pick up the 175-pound Thomas Inch dumbbell. So those are my overarching two goals. Within that, I'll be 50 this coming year. Obviously, I want to do those things as long as possible. And in my brain, if I can keep doing those things as long as possible, that has a lot of other, you know, longevity benefits associated, because the things I need to do that have, you know, lower body strength, grip strength, VO2 max, they're kind of baked into those goals also. But to me, those goals are more interesting. And it's something, like you said, I will train and put the effort for, as opposed to just increase your VO2 max. It's like,
what for? Yeah.
Yeah. What for? Right. Why do I want to do that? Why So I can go ride for 5 hours and not worry about being tired. Okay, cool. Now I'll do it.
Yeah. That's why I say, like, it's very hard to sell things except in the context of performance,
correct,
right? It's like,
yep.
Yeah. And I know I have some covert goals like that, but I feel like they're going to be less relevant for the listener, as kiteboarding is, right? Like I like to kite. I only go a couple of times a year, but I've been surfing loads recently. And so that's nice. One of my goals. Like, how do I not get beat up when I like go over the falls and get like smashed into like head foot high wave into like relatively still water and then put through the ringer as the whole wave unfolds? How do I not get injured there? And then also the Brazilian jiu-jitsu that I talked about with Rob Wolf. So I'm sure everybody has something like that, right? Like everyone cares about health span, but then they also have some other sub goals as well. Talk about VO2 max then. Do I have to like go into a lab and measure? I've heard you talk about this Pinoy device. What is it?
Yeah.
And is it reliable? Is it accurate? Is it validated? Like, tell me about that.
Yeah. So there's a couple of ways. So VO2 max, as listeners know, the maximal volume of oxygen you can run through your system at once. And if you don't have a fancy device, you can do a 12-minute Cooper run test. So go out, run 12 minutes. How far did you go in exactly 12 minutes? You can use a Concept 2 rower. You can do a 2K, so 2,000 meter row. Get on there, warm up, go as hard as you can for 2,000 meters. Go online. It'll give you, you know, what your VO2 max is. There's old school YMCA step tests and some stuff like that. So those would be kind of more indirect methods where we're not actually measuring any oxygen that your body is using. We're looking at your performance outcome, and then we're looking at this bunch of data, and we're saying, okay, here's about where you are at. If you get something called what's called indirect calorimetry or a metabolic cart, where people have seen, you know, the treadmill test, the person with the, you know, the mask over themselves, that's actually measuring the amount of oxygen and measuring the amount of CO2. And so what we said is the definition of a VO2 max. So it's the volume, the maximal amount of oxygen you can consume at once. So you would do some type of progressive ramp test. You have the device, and then the device is measuring the amount of CO2 that is produced and the amount of oxygen that's going and being used. And then you can look at the data, and you would see an actual measurement of your VO2 max. So it's more of a direct way of measuring what your VO2 max is. And then Pinoy is a company, but I do some affiliate work for them. They do have a metabolic cart that is quite a bit more inexpensive than ones. So the ones I used in the lab, when I was doing my PhD, I've done hundreds of metabolic cart tests. They're probably 40 to 50,000 a piece for just a piece of equipment. So the Pinoy is quite a bit less than that. I don't know exactly what the cost is right now, to be honest, but it's in the thousands. It's under 10,000. It does appear to be accurate. There's two studies that they did. They did a validation study. It was pretty close. There was another independent study that just came out a little while ago that showed it was relatively close. The caveat with that study is, if you want to know the fuel usage, so if you want to know, are you burning carbohydrates or are you burning fat, you probably have to do another step of what's called a gas calibration. So with the Pinoy device, you will run a set amount of known gas through it before you start a test. and that will calibrate the device a little bit more accurately than just running it off of ambient air. If you look at that subportion in that study, it was within the ballpark of the other devices. Now, the hard part about any of those comparisons is you're always just comparing to other devices. There, you know, in those studies, there isn't really like a quote-unquote gold standard. You're just seeing how do these other, I think it's 12 or 14 devices agree with each other.
And so this is something, I mean, even the Panoe device, this is probably not something I'm going to buy for myself at home as an individual, right?
The good part about it is, so one of the, I've been using it for, oh God, when did they come out? 4 years ago. And one of my biggest issues with it was not necessarily the device, the L-metabolic hearts to some degree are a little bit finicky, is that initially you just got the raw data. That was it. And I spent too many years staring at, you know, spreadsheets of raw data. So for me, it was no big deal. But if you didn't have a background in training, it was, oh, great. I got a bunch of raw data. Like, what the hell does any of this mean? It's just watching like the Matrix go across the screen. And so they've gotten a lot better now with the reports of saying, hey, we interpreted all your data now, and here's these different markers from metabolic efficiency, VO2 max, all these other things. And what's cool now is if you have a company, say, for example, a lot of wellness clinics now are measuring RMR and VO2 max, which is awesome because those are good markers for metabolic health. But a lot of the staff there are just not trained to look at those numbers because that's a, you know, separate field in exercise phys. So now you can work with Panoe and they have an option where you can literally send it to their data experts and they can even talk to your clients and explain to them what's going on. They can send you the finished reports back. So the nice part is they've offloaded a lot of the data analysis portion now, which you as a clinician or anyone makes it much easier because now you run the test, it goes up to the cloud, you can even have someone talk to one of their exercise physiologists, but you get the data that is meaningful to you in your clinical practice. And so that I think is actually super cool because one of the issues was I got all this raw data, what does it mean? And then two, how the hell do I explain any of this to a client that's in front of me? And that takes a lot of time to just do those things, even once you have the skill set. But now a lot of that can be done for you. Obviously, there's a price for that, but I think that's kind of a cool option.
Yeah, my experience working with clients, whenever you show them a number like this, the first thing they're going to say is, well, what does this mean? And you just explain how you can figure out what this means. And then the next thing they're going to ask, is this any good? How will you know, like, are there reference ranges? Like for,
correct.
You know, are they sex divided? Okay, so tell us about the reference ranges.
They have a little scorecard. So they have this little bar graph from like 1 to 10 in each one of these areas. And it'll tell you where you're at relative to population. Like most of this, they've got actually pretty good data. There's tons of great data on VO2 max and other metrics. And the nice part is that you can then look. And so I ran into this early with clients too of like, oh man, I think their VO2 max is horrible. But the first thing I would do is test it. And then I would show them, hey, here's your number, right? Even if I was just doing a 2K on the rower at the time before I had a device. And then I would show them how they rated compared to a population. Because even me just telling them that it's poor doesn't register. But I say, I'm like, hey, we had a client a couple of years ago. She was in the bottom 10% of a population for VO2 max. I'm like, here's where you're at. I'm not trying to make you feel bad. This is your data. This is your physical output. This is where you're at. She's like, oh my God, I didn't realize it was that bad. And so then she's like, well, how do I improve it? Right. So I think by showing people data, if it's low, they will say, okay, well, how do I improve it? So on a VO2 max may be good, but maybe your respiratory rate is off, or maybe there's other things you can work on. And again, like all things like performance, having this pre and post, because you can remeasure it and you can show, hey, you know, you actually did get better in this. So even though you hate cardiovascular training, we've been working hard at it for 8 or 12 weeks, you did get better in these measurements. So your output is actually getting better. You can see that you're actually getting improvement because sometimes you can feel it when you go from a low VO2 max to a higher number, but it's nice to have those numbers in front of you to be like, oh, wow, okay, all that effort that I didn't really like doing, it was worth it. And I can see that I'm actually physically better.
And so how much can you change it? You know, I was always, obviously there's tons of oodles of the entire literature on this, but
yep.
I was already almost under the impression that at least from a sports performance perspective, you know, if you were, like, it's not, VO2 max is not, it's like maybe one leg of the stool in most sports, you know, like I'm thinking, pick a random example, cyclocross, right? Like,
yep.
I don't care what your VO2 max is. If you crash your bike on the first corner, or if you get a flat tire because you didn't prepare your bike very well, then you're still going to lose, right? Like the VO2 max alone is obviously not enough. But how much can it be trained? You know, I just always assumed it was largely determined by genetics and there wasn't much you could do.
So VO2 max is super interesting because on one hand, you're 100% correct, but yet it's trainable. So what that means is there is an extremely high genetic component to VO2 max. You can look at the Heritage study that was done at the University of Minnesota. Depending on what study you read, what sub-analysis you read, who do you believe, maybe 50 to 70% of VO2 max is just straight out of the gate genetic. And what you'll find is that you find younger endurance athletes who just by virtue of their age have a crazy high VO2 max. So the rumor, which you probably heard about Lance Armstrong, is that I think he was like 17 or 18, you know, walked into Cole's lab in Texas. And he's like, I bet I have the highest VO2 max of anyone you've ever tested. And so the guy who was running the lab, you know, goes to Cole and he's like, yeah, there's this kid out here who says he has like the highest VO2 max we've ever seen. Like, what do you want me to do with them? And he's like, well, measure them. He's like, oh, okay. And it was, I don't know, like 70 or something like that.
Yeah.
So very, very high. Obviously, just by being very young, you could not have had enough time training to get to that number. So there is a very high genetic component to it. But a better question then is, okay, if you're not one of the genetic freaks who has that, there's a second component to that where if you have a very high VO2 max, the percentage of what you can use of that VO2 max a lot of times may not be real high. So again, to your point about VO2 max is one of the things I would look at for performance, but is not the greatest thing for performance, right? Because otherwise, when Lance Armstrong, for example, switched from cycling to the marathon, he would have destroyed everyone in the marathon, which didn't happen. He did well, but he didn't destroy everyone just because he had a really high VO2 max. So helpful, but not the be-all, end-all. Again, there isn't probably one parameter that will predict all sports performance anyway. But the other question then is, okay, so if, like, for example, I definitely did not win the genetic lottery for any VO2 max numbers at all, period. The next question is, how trainable is it? And it turns out it's extremely trainable up to a point. So I would argue that most people with training could probably hit 50, you know, milliliters per kg per minute, which is pretty high, but not crazy high. It's not elite athlete status by any means, but it's higher compared to where most people would start. But with months to many years of training, I think it's something that most people could do. If you think about muscle mass, right? Muscle mass is something that's very trainable, but there's definitely going to be some genetic freaks who are going to get much higher than other people, even if everything else was the same. But 50 is probably a pretty good number. If you look at the longevity data, you probably don't need to go, you know, much higher than that. So it is very trainable. And most people I find respond more similarly to aerobic training than they do strength training. Like strength training, I find there's just a lot more variability in program design and how people respond to stuff, their history and everything else. I find the response to aerobic training tends to be shorter, meaning you could take someone who, let's say their VO2 max, I've had people come in, their VO2 max is like 31, and within 2.5 years, they've gotten close to 50, right? Now, that's pretty dedicated program. That's them doing a lot of training. That's a lot of work, but it's within a few years. If you said, I want to maximize your muscle mass naturally, you're talking decades, right? You're not talking a couple of years. So I do think it is more trainable than most things. It does take time and effort. The other argument I would make is that once you get to a certain level, it doesn't take nearly as much, like all things, to hold that amount.
So well, I would make an argument for question. People. Once you got it, can you keep it? Right. Does it take as much work to hang on to it?
Not much. Like, and we see this with muscle mass too, right? The longer it takes you to attain something, that slope is also much more gradual on the other side. And, you know, assuming any injuries or bed rest or extreme circumstances.
That's so interesting, isn't it? Yeah, I feel that's been that my experience too. You know, I used to perform at a high level and do a 20 to 30 hours a week of training. And I still feel like I could go out and ride my bike 5 hours a day, having not really done much of anything recently and be absolutely fine. And you know, other people would be like, would think that was a big deal. Like other people I was riding with were like, this is,
yeah, totally.
I don't know if I can do it. That's just so interesting. But I guess a lot of that is the genetic thing as well, right?
It is. But you know right away if you're a genetic freak or not in most of those things, right? I mean, if you're that high, odds are your endurance has always just been easy for you. Then if you're not, I would say just, you know, get a test, see where you're at, you know, try to get better. And the curve, at least for longevity stuff and like the JAMA study, and Peter T has talked about this too, there's a huge difference from going from completely sucky to just being average. Like you get a lot of pickup from that. Now, do you get a little bit more from going average to being, you know, more towards a high level athlete, but not elite? Yes. Do you get a lot of pickup if you wanted to go from high level athlete to elite athlete? Not really. And you're probably not going to get there, to be honest. Most people probably won't.
What about cyclists? I know there's a lot of cyclists listening, myself included. Is there, you know, you mentioned running, you mentioned rowing. Mm-hmm. Is there a way to cut? So if I know how many watts I produce average over 20 minutes and I know my body weight, is there a way for me to convert that to VO2 max?
There probably is, but for whatever screwball reason, I can't find a good formula. Like I can No, it's weird. If someone has it, like please send it. I'm sure there's some cyclists out there who's tracked every ounce on their bike and their, you know, functional power output since 1984 that's going to send me a link to it. But
it's probably built into Strava or like Garmin or something.
You can find numbers 100%. Like there's tons of things that give you numbers. I can't seem to find one that I would say is based on a reliable data set, unfortunately, okay. Which seems weird because cycling is the most like heavily data driven sport, I think, on the face of the planet.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Like everyone's running a power meter now.
Yeah.
That's the future of running, right? Or rowing.
Yeah.
Right? It's like Jordy, Bree's husband, is a rowing coach. I don't think they know power when they're in the boat on the water. I don't think they do. They have $60,000 carbon fiber boats, but I don't think they know how much power each rower is producing.
No. Which is why a lot of them use like the Erg or the Concept 2, because it gives them hard data all the time. Especially if they don't have access to a course. So
but of course, that's different. That's like a model of the thing that you really care about. But it's not, presumably there's not as much or the same skill in the rowing itself when you're on the water.
It's different, but it's, again, probably as close as you're gonna get.
What about resting metabolic rate? I know this is something else the Pinoy measures. Valuable? Does it matter?
You can make two arguments. So I would say yes and no. So how I use it is, a lot of clients who their weight loss stalls, unfortunately, this tends to be more females than males, although I've definitely seen it in males too. They're utterly convinced because they spend too much time on the internet that their resting metabolic rate must have just crashed and they're walking around at like 800 calories per day. And I could do whatever I want to try to convince them that there's no way in hell that it's 800 calories per day, but they don't really believe you. If I do a measurement and I put them at rest and I actually get a measurement and I show them that, hey, yours is like 1325, they're like, oh, wow, that's crazy. I didn't know that. Now, we could argue all day, does that radically change what I would do with them? Maybe not. But what I've noticed is that they all of a sudden now feel much more compliant and they listen a lot better. So I like to use data to try to disprove some of the things that they think are going on. The other hard part is that the equations for resting metabolic rate, they will get you in the ballpark. But I've noticed on an individual level, there's still a fair amount of variability in it. And so, yeah, you can use those equations as, you know, if you look at the studies and if you look at the curves, standard distribution, all that kind of stuff, they, for a population, they're pretty okay. But on an individual level, I just noticed that they kind of break down a fair amount. So again, that's why using a direct measure, if I find, is useful. The next question is, can you radically change your resting metabolic rate? It's not as plastic as what I used to believe. It tends to be a little bit more fixed. A lot of that could be related to, you know, sleep and, you know, how much muscle you have and all those kind of things. So it's not something that we do know that weight loss, if you lose muscle, like your resting metabolic rate will change. But again, people think when they hear change, they think, oh my God, it dropped by 500 calories. It's like, no, we're talking 50, 70, 100 calories. It doesn't have these massive swings as much as what people have been led to believe.
Interesting. So you can't really change it then, is what you're telling me. What's the biggest change that you've seen?
I mean, the biggest change I've ever seen is only a couple hundred calories, which could very well be. And this is, again, this is individual to individual over a period of time. Now, again, the parts that we don't know is the conditions that kind of go into it. Like if they didn't have as good a night's sleep, does that affect it? We do know there's some very interesting stuff with the fuel that you use at rest. So one of the things you'll look at with a metabolic heart, like a new breath-by-breath analysis, is you can get the RER, so the respiratory exchange ratio, which in English tells you how much fat and how much carbohydrates you're burning. Yeah. And so a lot of times that's also the thing that people want to know. Okay, how many calories am I burning and where does the source come from? And in the past, I've just done this. Okay, we're overnight fast. Don't consume anything beforehand. Do it first thing in the morning. And if the number was low, like 0.7, you would say, great, at rest, you're using about 100% fat. If it's higher, so 0.85, 50% carbs, 50% fat. If it's one or higher, you're 100% carbohydrates. And so I did a fair amount of these tests in the lab and then here too. And then I started getting some weird stuff with like higher end athletes. So one guy in particular, Ryan Baxter, actually, who you know.
Ryan's been on the podcast.
Yeah. And so he has a Pinoy device. So he was doing measurements at his house.
No way. He has a Pinoy device at home. That's amazing.
Yeah, which is great. I'm like, oh, this is so fun. And his RER was coming in at like, you know, 0.86, 0.89. I'm like, what the heck? This guy's like legit DEXA, you know, single digit body fat. I've seen all of his blood work. Like I do his training. Like I know his work capacity. I know his output. I'm like, that doesn't make sense. I'm like, just do it again. Like the machine's weird. Something's messed up. Does it again. Almost the exact same number. I was like, what the hell? Like, this isn't making sense. And so I said, okay, get on and just do 50 watts on a bike and just measure it. As soon as he does any exercise, drops to like 0.7, 0.72. And as you know, like 50 watts on a bike is basically almost nothing. That's like it's not much output at all.
Soft pedaling, yeah.
Yeah, just soft pedaling on a bike. There's nothing hard. And I'm like, weird. And so I've seen that with a couple other people now too. And the caveat is, these are people who were generally relatively healthy, who were in a caloric surplus with higher amounts of carbohydrates. So even though we had that 8 to 12 hour fasting period overnight, I don't know if that's enough to change the RMR fuel usage in those people. Because if you didn't take these into context, you would look and you go, this guy, like metabolically, something's wrong with him, right? This doesn't, he should be using fat at rest. So with higher level athletes now, if I see a weird reading, I'll be like, okay, do this again, but just go like 50 watts on a bike or just go for a walk or do some movement. If it doesn't drop down then, okay, now I'm thinking there might be something going on. But in those cases, it's always drop back down and everything is sort of normalized. So again, can I point to any studies that have done this? No. Can I point to any research that's looked at this? No. But I've seen it enough times now where I think it does explain some of the variability in some of those studies. Again, on healthy people that by all other terms have you know, metabolic superstars.
Okay, interesting. I'm feeling like I should probably direct people to a previous episode that we've done on metabolic flexibility rather than we going down
kind
of rabbit hole of like, why does the RER matter?
Yeah, we went down the nerd chute pretty hard there.
yeah. Let's pull up there. You know, one thing I'm interested to hear your thoughts on is biological age. I know that it's reported by the Pinoy device and, you know, at MBT, we've used PhenoAge and, you know, I've had my own attempts at trying to create a biological age using the NHANES data. And then most recently I've done that linked to the mortality files. You know, can you use supervised machine learning to predict mortality using the NHANES data? I think the answer is yes. That yields a model that has skill. And then, you know, you look inside of this model, what are the features that are most important? So it's like an explainable model. You could call this biological age if you want. It might be useful for answering that question, you know, where am I at now? Am I getting better? But what do you think about all that?
I mean, I think at some point we will figure it out. And to your point, I think it depends upon, like all things, right? As you know better than I do, like the data you put in the model is going to be also determinant, right? So the model you guys use, the NHANES data is probably the biggest data set we have. However, you could argue that's probably of people who are not real healthy. You know, that's just population at wide. And so if I take that data set and I apply it to people who are very active, who have a high VO2 max, have all these other things, are they representative enough in that data set to give me an accurate prediction? I don't know. I wonder about that. But then the next question is, okay, well, we don't have very good data sets on super healthy people, period, at least to that level. So what would you base it on and how would you kind of figure it out? Like there's everything from, you know, blood work and weighting different things on algorithms to methylation clocks to whatever. My bias, if I were to pick one, kind of my background's exercise physiology, I would be more interested in an output verification model, right? So I'd be looking at resting heart rate, HRV, VO2 max, some type of body strength, maybe body comp, like things that are quote unquote more output based, because that's going to give me a better sum of all of the biological functions that go into that, as opposed to trying to back regulate and look at all the underlying things. And again, maybe AI can figure all that stuff out. And if we had a really good data set, I'm sure it probably could. But again, you're the AI expert, not me on that. But in the meantime, my bias is I just err more towards specific outputs because that is the sum of all of those kind of biologic functions.
I wouldn't describe myself as an AI expert, but I do recognize the problem you're describing. It's generally referred to as the propensity matching problem, right? Mm-hmm. The people in your data are not like that used to right. train your model are not like the ones that you're making at inference time. And yeah, we've already seen that with athlete clients. I mean, you like me are a big advocate of protein, and you're going to see elevated BUN in
yep.
people eating adequate protein.
Creatinine will be higher. Data.
Yeah, who knows how much they were, you know, like they do these food frequency questionnaires at NHANES. Maybe they're eating a lot of protein. I don't know. Maybe that protein was wrapped with a bun and onions and ketchup and came from McDonald's. Like that yeah. could be true too. Like, yeah, I really
And then
don't
you
know.
Get into
and then
the, also, the self-report data, like where did the data come yeah, from? Like what was the recall? Nonsense. How accurate is the recall? And
yeah,
you can go really far down that rabbit hole.
Yeah, it's mostly nonsense. And then, yeah, we also see it in the liver enzymes, you know, like people who work out, then like occasionally they get, and it's highly variable. Sometimes they get elevations of liver enzymes that they may be strongly predictive of very bad things, as the BUN would, like think about kidney mm-hmm. failure. Like you might see that, right? Like this is like end stage kidney disease in one person, but in others, it just means they had like a lot of protein today and then went had a workout yesterday, right? Like it's not, like these yep. two things are not the same. You mentioned Ryan Baxter knew his body composition there. And I'm sure, in fact, I know because I've worked with Ryan. Pretty mm-hmm. sure he measured that with DEXA, right? But
yep.
DEXA, like everything else we've talked about, it's kind of a pain to go somewhere to get that measured. What do you think about, you know, our friend and like two times, I think, podcast guest Jason Moore recently mm-hmm. launched an app called Spren. You know about that. He's doing body yeah. composition. Do you know about that?
Yeah, I know what it is. I don't know how it does it, to be honest, though. But yeah, I know Jason.
Okay, yeah. So Spren, you should check it out. So obviously, yeah, it's using vision analysis, right? So it's a sort of, I'm not exactly sure how it works, if I'm honest, but you take pictures from the front and from the side, and then using some sort of image classification, it's giving you body composition, not just body fat, but it's also like reporting Android fat and other things. And I think there are some data validating the approach, at least, if not the app specifically. And I talked to Greg Potter recently, you know, Greg, and yep. he thinks there are other algorithms that use video that are even more accurate. But that's not, I mean, how do you measure body composition with clients typically?
You know, some clients I have will do DEXA. The caveat, you know, talking to like Eric Helms and Grant Tinsley's lab has done, you know, tons of stuff on DEXA. I had both those guys on the podcast. In the past, not with my own clients, I've talked more people off the ledge because they got a DEXA 4 to 6 weeks after each other and the results don't match up with what they were seeing. So at best, if you're going to do DEXA, my opinion right now is maybe the most frequent I would do it would be every 6 months. And then ideally you would do the same DEXA location, the same, you know, whatever you do to lead up to that. There's debate about how much nutrition impacts that. Some studies say yes, some studies say no. But I have noticed, like Ryan picked this up too, that he went and did a DEXA at a different place and the result was like quite a bit different. And I'm like, I've seen enough DEXA scans and pics of, you know, half naked people now throughout my life that DEXA doesn't
look
right.
One of your favorite things to do. It's like,
not driving here.
Of a half the...
And yeah. it turned out that this DEXA place wasn't used to doing athletes. And there's an equation in the back that says athlete model or kind of more general population model. They picked the wrong one. When they went back and he had them change that and re-output it, then everything was fine. So again, there's equations in the background that again, the model is predictive based off of the DEXA too. So what I do in practice is pictures, circumference, and I actually use daily body weight. So I look a lot at daily body weight and then performance. If you're trending down in body weight and your performance is still going up, cool. We're probably doing pretty good. Like the odds of you losing muscle, very low. Again, you could argue that they're doing all new exercises and maybe they're new to exercises and neural adaptation and blah, 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 all this stuff. If that trend continues, I'm not that worried. If performance starts dropping off really hard and we're having them in a very extreme caloric deficit, okay, maybe there's some muscle loss. Again, hard to say. But the nice part about body weight is it obviously isn't telling you body comp. But you can get the measurement every day. And so I have a highly repeatable thing that even with like probably the worst scale you pick up is probably accurate within half a pound or a pound, right? The accuracy of even the worst measurement system is pretty good. And then I'll have them do circumference measurements using like a myotape, some more, you know, kind of physique clients. I say relative strength clients may do pictures, that type of thing. It just depends on where they're at. But I think the scale and performance are very underutilized, and they're very easily accessible pieces of equipment that people can get, and they don't need any real skill to do it. And the last part I've noticed too is that when someone's trending down and their body weight doesn't change within like half a pound or less, most of the time they're also reached a plateau in just being stuck. So that variability that they see day-to-day measurement, for whatever reason, that appears to go away. And so I look at the average, I look at the trend, and I just eyeball the variability change. And what I've noticed over the years of looking at friggin' hundreds of probably thousands of data points is that when that variability goes away and they're weighing in at like 131.5, 131.7, 131.3, and they're like complaining that just nothing's moving, the variability went away. Where normally they were maybe 133.9, you know, 134. It would vary a little bit each day. So that's something I've noticed too. And I'll look for that and see if the variability is kind of disappearing. And I know we're like really tight on a time schedule, so they have a competition or something they have to perform. I'll be more aggressive on changes to calories and exercise than waiting for it to completely plateau.
You don't worry about the negativity bias. I heard, where was it? I think it might have been on Dan Pardy's Human OS podcast back in the day. I heard Dan Ariely, the famous psychologist, talk about Shaper scale. Do you know about that? Or it didn't report a number on the device, just a light that showed that you were headed in the right direction if your goal was weight loss or fat loss, which people really want. But do you not run into that with your clients? You're like measuring their weight every day, and like every time they see a number move in the wrong direction, they're like, ah, shit. And then whenever they see it, like the sort of, you know, the criticism in which case the weight is going up is like Velcro, right? Like really stiff. And then the green lights are like Teflon. They just like bounce right off. Do you not run into that with clients?
I have. I mean, so to me, it's like, okay, if the weight is constantly disturbing your state, then we'll have a discussion about it and see what we want to do. What I won't do is drop to only doing it once a week, because that number will fluctuate so much that I don't even know if I'm making the correct decisions or not. So it's either, okay, let's do some other measurements. Let's maybe not even do it. Let's try on your pair of favorite jeans every 8 weeks, or let's do something else completely different. If it's completely destroying your state and we can't change it, then yeah, I'm not going to have them do a body weight. Another tip I got from my friend Allie Gilbert and Luke Lehman is, I'll have them switch it to kilograms, because nobody in the US knows their weight in kilograms.
Oh no, that's not going to work for a while.
You do, but the average person's like, oh, what the hell this is, you know? I've tried to get people to put sticky notes over their scale and have it directly report into chronometer. I've done that a few times. Okay. I've had, in worst cases, their spouse weigh them, and in old school before we had digital things that would help us, like have them report it back to me. There's ways around it, and they all have their pros and cons, you know.
That's amazing. Well, there's a couple of questions. You gave me an hour of your time, and I've already taken an hour of your time. But sort of the question, what workout should I do today? And I had Paul Larson on recently talk about his Athletica.ai.
Oh, nice.
Which I think is like really interesting technology for endurance athletes. But I mean, what are you doing for this now? Are you just creating customized plans for everyone? Do you have cookie cutter plans available? How does it work?
Yeah, so I probably spent too long creating completely custom plans for everyone, which, God, is that a monster pain in the ass, you know, because like, and to me, when I started, I was like, okay, this person's an individual. They're paying me a lot of money to do this custom. And this is before I even put stuff online. I did old school spreadsheets. I draw everything out by hand. It would literally take me like 2 to 3 hours to do it. And then probably maybe 3 or 4 years ago, when I was kind of forced into the 21st century and using software online just to make my life easier, I said, okay, I've got to, you know, use this new software. I've got to take all my old spreadsheets and put them into this new program. And so I said, okay, I'm going to give myself a week. I'm going to go through all the old programs. I'm like, maybe I should look to see, like, was I doing the same thing over and over? And it turns out, like, on my own analysis of like 10 years of data, I was like, wow, like 70% of the stuff for at least the first phase was almost the same, or it followed a very similar pattern. I was like, oh crap. And so what I did then is I created templates based off of what I had done before for like a high level endurance athlete, high level CrossFit athlete, strongman competitor. Like I had these kind of archetypes based on actual real people I had coached. And then my thought pattern was the extremes will inform the means. So if I'm good on the extreme end of the spectrum, I can look at that program and I can take stuff out to kind of get it down to, you know, where that person might be. I can't take an average program and scale it up to someone doing a pro strongman meet, right? It just, you kind of have to just start over. It just doesn't scale up. And so once I did that, then I said, okay, well, how do I know if I'm right? So I came up and I redid all my assessments. So on the high end, there's like a whole week of assessments from power output, breathing, range of motion, HRV, resting heart rate, aura, whatever. And then that will inform how I tweak the template so that the template kind of starts the same and I have an idea of where they need to go. But then that assessment will change where they're at, and then that assessment customizes it to them.
Okay. And is this like, but you still got to work with you one-on-one in order to get access to this, right?
Yeah, I do some one-on-one work, not a lot. I limit it to like 12 people. And I've got a course that I do for the Flex Diet Mentorship where I kind of teach people how to do online training for most people. Because the other part I realized is I was spending way too long writing these programs because I even still do this sometimes. I write them out on like, this is how old school I am. I have like big notebooks and I write shit out in a notebook and then I would put it online. But the part that I never fully realized was, well, what parameters am I changing each week? So for example, I would do a lot of changing of a total number of volume of work. And so I would go in on each little exercise and change the volume. So I was spending like 10 minutes just to change the volume for a workout for a week. I'm like, well, that's stupid because I would change it normally for most exercises. So then I realized if I just change the volume at the top, I get the same effect, but it takes me literally like 90% less time. So I figured out what are the loading patterns that I use over and over again. And the loading will tend to change per day, not per exercise. There's some exceptions to that. So that way I can just make a little note at the top of each day. And that saved me, oh God, hours of time extrapolated over, you know, 10 to 15 clients. There was no difference to the client. They got the exact same output. It was the same thing they were doing. I just realized I'm like, oh, I can make my life easier doing this process.
Okay. And so for someone listening, like, so the best way to get access to this is what, right? You've only got 12 coaching spots. Maybe they're all taken. Like to find a coach that's been trained by you. I didn't even know that you were doing that.
Yeah. You can just send me an email. Like I'm probably, okay. So what I did before is I had the Flex Diet Mentorship, which was 6 months. So I did 1 week of business. So week one was business, and then it was online assessment and training, a mindset, and then a personal development. And then those would cycle each month. So each month you'd have one topic from there. And we'd have like biweekly calls, and I have like little 20-minute modules. What I'm going to probably test out this next year is splitting that into either, you know, if you're a trainer or a coach, like the business side, which is more content newsletter based. And then how do you write online programs and how do you do online assessments? And I'll probably do those two as like intensive, like 6 week courses. Then is what I'm probably thinking.
Well, that was going to be my next question. I mean, I've worked with you and that was my question. I mean, I know what I'm doing today because you've told me what I'm doing, but yeah. Am I doing it right? Like, is that, I have no idea what I'm doing right. Mike's not here now. Is that enough weight? Well, I guess maybe you've even told me the weights and stuff, but is my form correct? Like, what do you do? I mean, endurance stuff is easier, I think, right? Like you've got a power meter on your bicycle. Like, you know, like you've got wattage targets and you're hitting those, heart rate or whatever it is. It's like pretty easy to know that you're hitting those. But with a strength training, it's like way harder, don't you think? So how do you know, especially for endurance athletes who are kind of naive to strength training, how do they know whether they're doing it right?
I do a lot of video. So I'd be like, hey, give me a video of that, post it below. I use True Coach for that. Like when we would work with you, I did a lot of heart rate variability. If they have an aura, you can cross-check aura.
If that's going backwards to the where am I now and am I getting better, right? Like, you know, you know that whether I've got good form in the exercises I've been forming just from my HRV data.
You can kind of back calculate it. So for example, I had a client where aura was fine, sleep was fine, nutrition was on point. every day after they did a heavy squat, their HRV would just be trashed. And I'm like, okay. And so I started thinking it was the loading of the squat. So we pulled back on the loading, didn't change. I get a video and it was a very horrendous looking squat. In that case, that can be a little bit higher stressor on their system. You'll see more of a drop in HRV. It doesn't always show up that way, but exercise form can be a stressor, especially for, I've noticed, like axial loaded exercises. And the other way you can get around it too is by having them do a range of motion test. So like, hey, take your baseline range of motion, toe touch, do an exercise, measure it again. If your range of motion is always getting worse, that means that your body is not liking that exercise. So let's change it. Let's go to a B stance. Let's change the loading, or let's drop it entirely. And then we'll come back and readdress that later.
Oh, that's fascinating. That's really interesting. Yeah, you're reminding me, we're off to Costa Rica on Monday. Last time we went to Costa Rica in 2019, it was to stay at Ben House's retreat center.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You've been there, haven't you?
Yes, I've been there many times. Beautiful place.
Yeah. It is beautiful. And I remember we were there with some endurance athlete clients, and I would include myself in this cohort, right? Like Ben's like, well, let me see, before I load you up, let me see you do this. And he's like, okay, let me see you do this. And I'm like, okay, let me see you do this. It's like, yeah, I don't think I want to put any weight on that, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of typical of endurance athletes, you know?
Yeah. And I've gotten wiser with programming that over the years, right? So rarely do I ever program a back squat. Like if it's an endurance athlete, like my favorite squatting motion is either a goblet squat or double kettlebell front squat. It's just much harder to mess it up. And depending on where they're at, they probably don't need to be loaded pretty heavy. I mean, if you can do 232 kg kettlebells and knock out, you know, 12 reps of a, you know, front squat on those, that's pretty damn impressive. And that's not elite level status, but that's a much harder task than what I think people realize. So I think with loading, you can kind of, because after you do this long enough, you'll see what patterns break down first. And so I tend not to program those nearly as much.
Okay. All right. One last bonus question, because I just can't resist. It's a gadget. You know, like us tech people, we love gadgets.
Yeah.
Even though they always end up in the gadget graveyard eventually after we buy them. I still love talking about them and buying them and stuff. What about the Moxie oxygen sensor? I've heard you talk about this a lot. What is it? What can it do for you? Is it any good? Can you, like, is it something that can inform your decision making?
I actually like it. I've known Roger as the CEO there for many years. I saw him present at the medical device conference years ago when it first came out. And basically what it is, it's a NIRS device. So you put it over the muscle, and by using near infrared light, then it'll tell you the oxygen utilization of a local muscle. And so the thing that blew me away, God, probably 7-8 years ago now, was when I first saw the device. I think it was Aaron Davis from Evolve. They put this person on a rower, and they said, okay, let's do 30-second wind gate, right? So rower max, hard as you can for 30 seconds. They have the Moxie device on and they have the display. So he starts at, you know, 85% oxygen level in the muscle. By the end of the 30 seconds, the oxygen level was down to like 11%. And I'm sitting there going, well, hold on, this device is a piece of shit. There's no, I was told this is anaerobic exercise. You're not using oxygen during these high intensity output things. And long story short, that messed me up for like 6 years to try to figure out like what the hell is going on. It turns out the device is accurate, that you are always constantly using oxygen in the background, even if something is, quote, anaerobic. But once you understand that, that allows you to like kind of the next level of programming of, okay, is it a central limitator, right? Is it a cardiac limitator? Or is it kind of a peripheral limitator? It's a high level. And so if I put someone on a rower and let's say, let's have you do 30 seconds. Let's say they're doing a 2K, right? I had this happen the other day. They're doing a 2K. Their SMO2 starts at 85% after a good warm-up. If they're 1 minute into it and they're already at like 12%, oof, that's going to be an absolutely brutal 2K for them, right? Because your muscle is operating at such a low O2 environment already.
You're going out
versus someone who has more of a gradual decline. Again, the caveat being these two people had the same output. That's the part people forget. We're comparing people who have the same output. And so it gives you an idea of peripherally, like local musculature, like what's going on. Is it a technique thing? Is it a training thing? You know, and you can go further down the rabbit hole from there.
I see. And so how would this inform your decision-making? What would you say to those two people?
Yeah, so it's different. So their rate limiter is going to be different. right? So if I've got a guy who just like his SMO2 just crashes initially, I'm like, okay, we're probably not going to, one, drive you into the paint doing 2Ks all the time and just leave it down there. We might do what I call I got this from Evan Picon, like a progressive interval. So take a 4-minute interval, and at the last 30 seconds of that 4-minute interval, I want to see your SMO2 like as low as it can go, but I don't want to see it until that point. I want you to play with your pace and get used to seeing what output you can get progressively getting down to that low level, right? So I'm training the blood flow. And the other part I'm going to look at too is on your technique, when you're coming back, right? I'm just using normal speak, not rower speak. So when I'm bringing the handle towards me, that's obviously muscle contraction, right? But when you bring the handle back, I literally want you to think, relax. Because what do I want to happen at that point? I want those vessels and that musculature to relax and not compress the shit out of all those vessels. If it's tension still on and it's compressing those vessels, my SMO2 is going to stay low because I've basically hampered blood flow. So I want to see, can I get the muscle to relax more and get the same output and over time, potentially better output? So what I should see is for that output, my SMO2 shouldn't bottom out as hard because I'm getting more blood flow now to that muscle. So when we go to train again, and we go to do a competition or a test, now I can get a higher level of output from that because we've gotten higher levels of output during training.
I see. Very technical. I see the use case. Okay. And how often would you use this device when working with athletes? Is it something you're using every day or?
It depends. It depends on how much of a pain in the ass they want to put into their training, to be honest.
Okay. Okay, got it.
Because it is a little bit of a pain. And after a while, like, they'll know, like, what outputs are, you know. So I may say, like,
you learn it, like heart rate, right? Like, I know, I don't need to keep wearing a heart rate monitor to know what my heart rate is, right? Like,
right.
You kind of learn the association.
Yep. The caveat, although this part kind of bugs me, I do think high-level athletes might use different compensation mechanisms depending upon different levels of fatigue. So initially when I started testing this, I would have the Pinoy device on. The Pinoy integrates with the Moxie. Because the longest time I was just like, okay, I want to know local muscle, what's going on. But I also want to know centrally what's going on too. Because if I just start hyperventilating, I just start getting rid of a ton of CO2. That's going to change the local muscle effect, right? It's the Bohr effect, right? So they're related to each other. And if you don't watch the person or don't know what their breathing rate was, you may assume that it's a local issue and it might not be, or vice versa.
I see.
So when I have the Pinoy, I can look at respiratory rate, I can look at RER, I can look at flow rates, I can look at all the stuff going in and out, them as a whole central unit. I'll put a Moxie on the right quad, left quad, and then their deltoid. So if I see a change in a non-active muscle group, that may tell me they've got a cardiac limitation in that the brain goes, well, screw this. We don't need any blood flow to this little deltoid muscle. Like, we need more blood flow to the quads, right? So that may give you an idea of a central adaptation. The hard part with all of that to say is I'm not convinced you could test an athlete once and have that always be their limiter for a period of time, which is annoying, right? Because my thought process going into it was, great, you come out here, we'll do all this testing. Boom, we find your limiter. Great, we destroy your limiter for like 8 weeks. Boom, now you're better. But what I've realized is I think, depending on fatigue and depending on other things, your limiter might change on a day-by-day or week-by-week basis. And I don't have a good handle on that, to be 100% honest. So that would make the argument of training with a Moxie. So you're training to, just like training to heart rate, right? But now I'm training to another physiologic thing that's connected to performance. So if I'm training, okay, I want you to bottom out as hard as you can at the end of 30 seconds. Okay, go again once you hit 85% and then go again, right? So just like depletion intervals. It wouldn't matter what your status or your adaptation is that day, because I'm still going to those physiologic parameters anyway.
That would
be the argument of why you would use it daily for training.
I see. Well, Mike, you've been incredibly generous with your time as always. And to remind the listener, the Flex Diet Certificate program is open now and only now for maybe only one more time this year, right? So people,
possibly later this year, but right now, January 15th through the 22nd, it's just flexdiet.com.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much. Is there anything else you want people to know about?
No, that's about it. If they want more information from me, I have a daily newsletter that I try to make somewhat interesting and not quite as geeky as this, but we do get pretty geeky there. You can go to MikeTNelson.com and there'll be a way you can hop on the free newsletter there. That's where probably like 90% of my content goes out to the newsletter.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Mike. I really appreciate you. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate it.